jak tutaj jak znaczy sposobu.
Wiesz, weil dein Körper so alles möglich ist.
It can through the body and scan through the body and see if there are any tensions anywhere. And then let go of them and relax them.
Und wir gehen den Körper durch und prüfen, ob irgendwo Spannungen sind. Und wenn welche da sind, lassen wir sie los und entspannen.
Make your body sink into the cushion more and more.
Wir lassen den Körper mehr und mehr in das Kissen hineinsinken.
This space is so important for the body to fade into the background.
Diese Grundlage ist so wichtig, damit der Körper in den Hintergrund treten kann.
And focus your attention on the peaceful and calm surroundings, on the peaceful atmosphere here, and let it flow through your being.
Ich will ein bisschen unsere Aufmerksamkeit auf diese friedliche Umgebung, auf das friedliche, die friedliche Atmosphäre, die hier herrscht, und lassen uns davon ganz durchdringen.
Enjoy being in the present moment and allow mindfulness to arise.
Und wir bleiben im gegenwärtigen Moment und erlauben der Achtsamkeit aufzusteigen.
when the mindfulness is established.
Die Achtsamkeit baut sich auf.
And the breath will arise naturally, without force, without willpower, just of its own accord.
Wenn die Achtsamkeit da ist, wird der Atem ganz natürlich da sein, für die Aufmerksamkeit, ohne Anstrengung. Ganz von selbst.
And when the breath has arisen naturally and shift, gently shift your attention to the breath.
Und wenn der Atem aufgetaucht ist, ganz natürlich, dann verschieben wir ganz fast unsere Aufmerksamkeit auf den Atem.
again go to meditation. Take a few minutes to reflect back on your meditation.
Wir kommen langsam zum Ende der Meditation und nehmen uns ein paar Minuten Zeit, um zurückzublicken.
How does your mind feel now?
Wie fühlt sich der Geist jetzt ein?
Und geht die Meditation well?
Wie ist die Meditation gelaufen?
Okay, so here we are again then. So I just had a meeting with Venerable Analayo because I'm in Germany only once every 10 years or something, so it was a kind of nice opportunity. So we'd like to meet him again. We're talking about translations of Chinese texts, that kind of stuff. Very interesting because he's one of the kind of leading scholars in the world for these things. It's very nice to meet people like that, and you get kind of new impulses and new ways of looking at things and all of that. So it's actually very nice. We didn't invite him here to say hello to everyone, but he didn't have time, so that's why it disappeared all of a sudden like that. So anyway, so this... Sorry, oh please, yeah, of course, yeah.
Ich habe mich mit Mami gesagt, mit dem Analayo getroffen. Der lebt hier in Deutschland und ich komme nur alle 10 Jahre oder so mal hierher. Und von daher war das eine schöne Gelegenheit, dass wir uns treffen konnten und wir haben über Übersetzungen gesprochen, aus dem Chinesischen und all die deutsch komplizierten Dinge und das war sehr schön. Er ist einer der führenden Wissenschaftler in diesem Bereich weltweit und es war eine wunderbare Gelegenheit, uns zu treffen. Und wir hätten ihn gerne eingeladen, auch hier reinzukommen und allen hier Hallo zu sagen, aber er hat wenig Zeit und deswegen ist er gleich wieder verschwunden.
Okay, very good. So this is the first question for tonight. Is as follows: Is Ajahn Brahm allowed to have milk in his tea in the afternoon, or has he to use soy milk like us? Thank you. Okay, so this is he allowed? That's interesting. So, in other words, does he consider it allowable? Presumably, is the idea here? And it's one of those very technical things, the Vinaya things. And there is good argument that neither milk nor soy milk is allowable. There is an argument that one of them is allowable but not the other one, or the other but not the one. There is an argument basically you can argue almost anything about these things. But they are such tiny little matters of Vinaya, I don't think they are really even worthwhile kind of disgusting because it's some people use milk and some use soy milk and some use neither, some use both. But I think all of those is kind of within what I would consider the acceptable range of the of vinaya conduct. So it's all a matter of how you read the vinaya and all matter of different interpretations. The two minor, I think, to really be concerned about. So Ajahn Brahm, normally he uses neither milk nor soy milk in for that matter. But I think occasionally, if depending on the situation, he might accept milk in the tea in the afternoon in certain circumstances. But usually we don't have soy milk at our monastery at all, nor do we use milk in the tea, if that helps. If you want to see me privately about this, you can, and we can discuss it privately. Okay.
Die Frage lautet, darf Ajahn Brahm in seinem Tee am Nachmittag Milch haben oder muss er Sojamilch benutzen, so wie wir hier? Und die Antwort lautet, wenn es heißt, darf er das, dann ist es wohl gemeint, ob er den Wiener ja so versteht, dass es erlaubt ist. Und das sind diese technischen Punkte in Vinaya, über die viel diskutiert werden kann. Und es gibt Leute, die sagen, weder Milch noch Sojamilch sind nach dem Vinaya erlaubt. Und es gibt Leute, die sagen, das eine ist erlaubt, das andere nicht. Und andere sagen es umgekehrt. Und andere sagen, beides ist erlaubt. Aber das Ganze ist so geringfügig, dass ich denke, all diese Varianten sind irgendwie in Ordnung. Und es ist wirklich so wenig bedeutsam, dass ich mir darüber den Kopf nicht zerbreche. Und Ajahn Brahm nimmt gewöhnlich weder Milch noch Sojamilch am Nachmittag. Aber abhängig von der Gelegenheit wird er auch vielleicht mal Milch annehmen. Ja, je nach den Umständen. Und in unserem Kloster haben wir normalerweise keine Sojamilch und am Nachmittag nehmen wir üblicherweise auch gar keine Milch.
Okay. Yeah? Yeah? Got it? Yeah? Okay, good. Okay, next one is as follows. Dear Bhante, there is so much about hearing the Dhamma, but how does a disciple talk about the Dhamma in a proper way? Thank you very much for an answer here. So how do you talk about the Dhamma in a proper way here? Basically, you talk about what you know, what you understand. So if you have read the suttas, you can talk about that. Yeah, if you have some personal experience, you can talk about those personal experience if you wish. Often it is best not to talk too much about personal experience, but you can, depending on the situation, all these kind of things. But essentially, talk about the Dhamma when you feel that you know what you're talking about. And if you are unsure about something, then be honest about the fact that you are unsure, because otherwise you might kind of hand on wrong kind of information about things. So that is how I would talk about Dhamma. And of course, sometimes you just need to have a chat to see if you have understood things correctly and to discuss things. And I think it's great. The Buddha actually recommends discussion on the Dhamma at least to some extent. You see in the suttas, you see sometimes the monks coming together once every 5 days or whatever. And sometimes they talk all night about Dhamma. There's a sutta where they meet every 5 days. And they talk all night just about Dhamma issues, about meditation practice and all of these kind of things. And they were supposed to have been arahants. And still they're delighting in discussing the Dhamma in this particular way here. So just be careful, don't overstep the mark. Don't say things that you aren't sure about. And then you can discuss pretty much whatever you like. And then you'll be fine here.
Die Frage heißt, es wird immer so viel vom Hören des Dhamma gesprochen, aber wie kann man als Schüler über den Dhamma auf angemessene Art sprechen? Und die Antwort ist, man kann das weitergeben, was man verstanden hat vom Dhamma. Und man kann auch über seine persönlichen Erfahrungen sprechen. Das würde ich raten, dass man das nicht zu viel macht. Aber je nachdem, wie die Situation ist, ist es schon möglich, auch über persönliche Erfahrungen zu sprechen. Und was auch vom Buddha in den Suttas immer wieder empfohlen wird, ist, dass man mit anderen über den Dhamma spricht, um überhaupt zu sehen, wie weit das eigene Verständnis reicht. Und die Mönche zur Zeit des Buddha haben einmal die Woche oder so sich zusammengesetzt und haben die ganze Nacht Dhamma diskutiert. Zum Teil auch, wenn sie schon Arahants waren, haben sie immer noch gerne über den Dhamma auf diese Art diskutiert. Und das sind Möglichkeiten, wie man über den Dhamma sprechen kann.
Okay, so if I don't answer your question properly, please try again later on, because sometimes I may have misunderstood or whatever. So you're always allowed to try again later on if you like. Okay, the next one. When moving forward on the path, it can happen that defilements especially the more subtle ones, appear to be much more prominent. How is it possible to discern between an actual increase of defilements and an apparent increase, which in reality is only a stronger perception of more subtle defilements? Thank you. I think the power of a defilement is really whatever you feel like. Yeah. So if the defilement feels very strong, it is because it is strong usually. Yeah. It is not just the subtle defilements which appear strong, it actually is. That's what is a defilement, is the perception of it and being strong. Yeah. So I think probably it is the same thing. Yeah. And sometimes when you move forward on the path, it may be like that because you are practicing restraint to some extent. You try not to kind of give rise to say wrong things and do wrong things and all of these things. Sometimes that restraint may kind of, there may be something inside of you that rebels against that, yeah? And that rebellion may sometimes come out in kind of defilements arising here. But generally speaking, I would say if it feels like a serious defilement, a perception is strong, usually that means that it actually is a problem at that time. Because that is really the only way you can know whether defilement is strong or weak, right? Through what it is perceived as. So if it felt strong, it probably is strong. If it felt as weak, then it is subtle. That's what I would say. So sometimes maybe it's just the beginning, practicing on the path, that gives rise to things because of a natural kind of clash maybe between what you want to do and what the path says you should be doing. Yeah.
Wenn man auf dem Pfad vorangeht, kann es passieren, dass Prüfungen, besonders subtilere Prüfungen, sehr in den Vordergrund treten oder in die Wahrnehmung hineinkommen. Und wie kann man unterscheiden zwischen einem tatsächlichen Zunehmen der Prüfungen und einer scheinbaren Zunahme, die in Wirklichkeit nur darin besteht, dass man diese feineren Prüfungen stärker wahrnimmt. Die Antwort ist, wenn die Kraft oder die Stärke von Prüfungen ist genau das, so wie es sich anfühlt. Das heißt, wenn sich die Prüfung stark anfühlt, dann ist es auch eine starke Prüfung. Dann ist es auch in dem Moment ein tatsächliches Problem. Und es kann passieren, wenn man Zurückhaltung übt, dass etwas im Inneren rebelliert und dieses Rebellieren kann sich dann auch als eine Prüfung äußern.
Okay. So, here we are, okay. So, this next question is about a question as follows. Does the Therigatha belong to one of the texts of early Buddhism? Would you tell us one story of a nun becoming an arahant? Thank you, Bhante. So the Therigatha, is a part of the early texts of Buddhism? And I would say part of it, I think, is probably very authentic. If you read some of the stories there, they rhyme very well with the early teachings of the Buddha. So I would say in large part they are. You look at the vocabulary, you look at the way it is phrased, it's very similar to early Buddhist texts. So in large part, I would say it is, but I think it's also a bit of a hodgepodge, a bit of a mixture here, because some of the nuns there are not actually found anywhere else except for in the Therigatha, and it's quite likely that books like this were open for a long period, and they included verses later on that were added later on. In fact, it's known that some of the verses in the Therigatha, okay, I should have explained what these books are for those of you who don't know, so that the Therigatha is the book on the verses of the elder nuns. That's what it means. Teri is an elder nun, and Gatha is a verse. So these are the verses collected by all the elder nuns, the disciples of the Buddha. And you know, when they got enlightened, or when they kind of passed away or something, they would express their appreciation or express their awakening through a set of verses. And these verses were then written down and were passed down in the Teri Gatha. And there's a parallel for the monks called the Tera Gatha. Tera is then a monk, and then the gathas of the elder monks as well. And some of all the famous monks in the suttas, all the famous nuns in the suttas have verses there, but some of the verses are fairly clearly later on, maybe even as late as the time of Ashoka and that sort of era. Would you tell us one story about the nun becoming an arahant? Thank you, Vanda. So this, some of the stories of the nuns becoming an arahant, there is a, I think there is one that I must admit, I'm not all that incredibly well-versed in this. Maybe the bhikkhunis here would be actually better placed in telling some of these stories. But I think one of the stories is there's a bhikkhuni which doesn't make enough progress on the path. She can't kind of reach the final awakening. Yeah, she gets really distraught and really upset that she can't go all the way to the end and become an arahant. And then so one day she decides to kill herself because of this. So she kind of gets up on throws a rope over a branch of a tree, right, puts the noose over her neck to hang herself. And just the moment when she's about to jump off and to hang herself, at that moment, bang, she becomes an arahant. Yeah, so it because I guess what is happening there is that the death contemplation becomes so powerful. You know you're going to die. And because you already, the Dhamma is already in your heart, you know what the Dhamma is all about, all you need is a little trigger. And that trigger then kind of enables you to gain that insight and bring about arahantship. That is one story here. Looks like correct, Aya? Yeah? Okay. Just to make sure I got it right, otherwise it's very embarrassing something here. So, there's another story of a nun who is also, she's kind of contemplating, I think, impermanence and cessation and these kind of things. And one day she's watching a candle. And then the wind comes and blows out the candle. And when she sees the candle go out, at that point, she becomes an arahant. Sounds too easy, right? You just have to watch a candle and go out, wow, arahant. The point is that you have done all the preparatory work, you have done all the contemplations. All you need is a final trigger to kind of get you there. And that is how these things happen. So please tell me off if I give any wrong information on that, because I So this is, there's some nice stories about nuns found in the Sanghita Nikaya. I'll read out one of those stories because these are really quite inspiring stories, actually. So this is the nun Vajjila. There's a Sanghita called the Bhikkhuni Sanghita in the Connected Discourses of the Buddha. And these are all the stories of bhikkhunis and what happened to them, especially when they were challenged by Mara, right? Mara is the impersonation of defilement in the mind. So when Mara comes, he always tempts you to do crazy and stupid things. And this is Vajjira, and she was obviously quite wise. I'll read out the story of Vajjira. So this happened at Savati, Savati being one of the great monasteries where the Buddha stayed. Then in the morning, the bhikkhuni Vajjira, dressed and taking her bowl and robe, she entered Savati for alms. When she had worked for alms in Savati, and had returned for her alms round. After her meal, she went to the blind men's grove for the day's abiding, means the day's meditation. Having plunged into the blind men's grove, she sat down at the foot of a tree for the day's meditation practice. Then Mara, the evil one, desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in the bhikkhuni Vajjira, desiring to make her fall away from samadhi, approached her and addressed her in verse. So this is Mara talking to this bhikkhuni, right? By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of the being? Where has the being arisen? Where does the being cease? I'm not entirely sure what he's probably entirely sure what that is about, but anyway, let's see what she replies. Then it occurred to the bhikkhuni Vajjira, now who is this that recites the verse? A human being or a non-human being? Then it occurred to her, this is Mara the evil one, who has recited the verse desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in me, desiring to make me fall away from samadhi. Then the bhikkhuni Vajjira, having understood it, this is Mara the evil one, she replied to him in verse, why now do you assume a being? Mara, is that your speculative view? This is a heap of sheer formations or sankharas. Here no being is found. Just as when an assemblage of parts, the word chariot is used, so when the aggregates exist, there is the convention of being. It's only suffering that comes to be. Suffering that stands and falls away. Nothing but suffering comes to be. Nothing but suffering ceases. Then Mara, the evil one, realizing the Bhikkhuni Vajira knows me, sad and disappointed, disappears right there. Okay, so this, okay, this, let me just very briefly comment on this before I hand it on to you here. So the idea behind this is obviously that she is obviously very attained, she obviously probably an arahant at this point, and she understands the idea of non-self. All of this is about non-self, right? The idea that there is no being means there is no essence inside of you that you can call the real you. This is what this is all about, in case you have any doubts about what is meant by this. This is a heap of sheer formations. In other words, this is just a heap of things that are compounded and created by cause and conditions. There's nothing here that kind of remains, no permanent essential being that actually is found here. And then this simile, the famous simile of the chariot, right? The chariot is assembled by parts. In the same way, a being, the conventional being, comes into existence when the five aggregates come together. And there's a very powerful saying at the end that it's only suffering comes to be, and nothing but suffering that ceases. Think about that one for a while, because that is really, really profound and really nice. Okay. So I need that, sir.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you want to have this question as well? Yeah.
Gehört das Theragata zu den frühen buddhistischen Texten, und kannst du uns eine Geschichte über eine Nonne erzählen, die ein Arahant geworden ist? Ja, das Theragata ist Teil der frühen buddhistischen Texte. Es ist sehr authentisch und es passt sehr gut mit den übrigen frühen Texten zusammen, wobei es ein bisschen gemischt auch ist. Es gibt Hinweise, dass zum Beispiel die Tatsache, dass einige Nonnen dort auftauchen, die sonst in den frühen buddhistischen Texten nicht vorkommen. Also könnte sein, dass dieser Teil des Kanons länger offen gewesen ist für Veränderungen, dass dann auch Pferde aufgenommen wurden aus etwas späterer Zeit. Also Theragata sind die Verse der ordensälteren Nonnen, und das Komplementäre dazu gibt es auch für die Mönche. Theragata sind die Verse der ordensälteren Mönche. Und die bekannten, berühmten Mönche und Nonnen haben alle Verse, die in diesen Sammlungen aufgenommen worden sind, zum Beispiel anlässlich des Moments, wo sie Arahants geworden sind, haben diese Verse besprochen oder kurz bevor sie gestorben sind, und die wurden dann in diese Sammlung aufgenommen. Und es gibt zum Beispiel eine Bhikkhuni, die große Mühe hat mit dem Fortschritt auf dem Pfad, und sie kommt irgendwo nicht weiter und wird ganz verzweifelt darüber und beschließt, sich das Leben zu nehmen, und sie hängt ein Seil über einen großen Ast an einem Baum und hängt sich die Schlinge um den Hals, und in dem Moment, wo sie losspringen will, plötzlich, da versteht sie, das Ganze hat den großen Durchbruch und wird ein Arahant. Das heißt, in dem Moment, wo der Tod so nah war, war das der Auslöser, der praktisch dazu geführt hat, dass sie diesen Durchbruch gefunden hat. Dann gibt es eine andere Nonne, die über die Vergänglichkeit viel kontempliert hat und über das Aufhören, und dann hat sie irgendwann da gesessen und beobachtet, wie der Wind eine Kerze ausgeblasen hat, und das war für sie der Auslöser für den letzten Durchbruch. Und in Sanghita Nikaya, in dieser Sammlung, gibt es ein ganzes Kapitel mit Geschichten über Nonnen, gibt es den Bhikkhuni Sanghita, da werden ganz interessante Geschichten erzählt, vor allem von Nonnen, die von Mara herausgefordert werden. Also Mara ist die Personifizierung der ganzen Anhaftungen und geistigen Trübungen. Und die Geschichte, die er hier vorgelesen hat, ist die über die Nonne Vajira, die sehr weise war. Und sie ging morgens auf ihre Almosenrunde, und nachdem sie ihr Mahl gegessen hat, ging sie in den Wald der Blinden und hat sich am Fuß eines Baumes da niedergesetzt, um ihre Meditation für diesen Tag zu machen. Und dann kommt Mara mit der Absicht, Furcht in ihr hervorzurufen und sie vom Samadhi abzubringen, und spricht sie an mit einem Vers. Von wem wurde dieses Wesen erschaffen? Wer hat das Wesen gemacht? Wo ist das Wesen entstanden und wo endet dieses Wesen? Und die Nonne Vajira hat sich gefragt, wer hat diesen Vers gesprochen, ist es ein Mensch oder ein nichtmenschliches Wesen? Und dann kam ihr gleich der Gedanke, das ist Mara, der Böse, und er will mich hier, will mir Furcht einflößen und will mich vom Samadhi abbringen, und hat ihm dann auch in Versen geantwortet und hat gesagt, warum nimmst du so etwas an wie ein Wesen? Mara, ist das deine spekulative Ansicht? Dieser Haufen von bedienten Sachen, da gibt es kein Wesen zu finden. Genauso wie wie für eine Ansammlung von Teilen der Begriff Wagen benutzt wird, so ist es, wenn diese Aggregate da sind, dass man das konventionell als ein Wesen bezeichnet. Es ist alles Leiden, nur was entsteht, und Leiden ist da und fällt wieder weg. Und nichts anderes als Leiden entsteht und nichts anderes als Leiden hört auf. Und auf diesen Pferdchen hat Mara, der Böse, verstanden, die Bikuni Vajira kennt mich, und war ganz enttäuscht und ist verschwunden. Sie hat offensichtlich die Idee des Nicht-Selbst verstanden gehabt und das berühmte, oder das, ja, das Gleichnis von diesem Wagen, das kommt wohl auch noch anderweitig vor. Und das Ganze gipfelt eben in diesem Ausbruch am Schluss: alles, was entsteht, ist Bleiben, und alles, was vergeht, ist auch Bleiben. Und das ist was anderes gibt es nicht.
Okay. So, the next one is as follows. Devante, regarding Sati Sampajanya, is the sutta saying this needs to be refined to the point that we are considering every possible outcome of a potential act of body, speech, and mind? Or is it a general skillful, unskillful designation that we're supposed to give and label it before acting? Thank you. Sati-sampajanya is about just asking yourself whether what you're doing has the right purpose. It's not so much about knowing the outcome, because the outcome is always going to be uncertain, right? But is what I'm doing now, is it roughly purposeful? Is it suitable? Sometimes you get it wrong, and that's fine. But you have a general idea whether you are doing the right kind of things. And of course, it is impossible to do that with every thought and everything you do. It's just too hard. But you have a kind of general, rough idea of whether you're doing the right thing. This is much easier if you are a monastic, because in monastic life, there's many, usually much fewer activities. It's like the main thing, you go into the village for alms, right? You go to the toilet and whatever else it is. Those basic things are what you kind of, where you have this idea of Sati-sampajanya. And of course, when you meditate as well, you also have some degree of Sati-sampajanya, but that is on a slightly different level. It's more like a general thing that you kind of stand back. And of course, the more mindfulness you have, the more ability you have to see what is going on, what is happening here. So really, the mindfulness is the most important criteria, the most important factor here, because that mindfulness enables you to know what is happening here. So you stand back, and you know, and then very quickly you pick up whether you're heading in the wrong direction or not. Okay, I'm going to the casino. Okay, don't want to go to the casino. Okay, so you stop yourself, yeah? That kind of thing, yeah. Especially if the monk is a bad idea to go to the casino. So,
okay, es geht um Sati-sampajanya, und heißt das in dem Sutta, dass es bis zu dem Punkt verfeinert werden muss, dass man jedes mögliche Ergebnis einer Handlung mit dem Körper, der Sprache und dem Geist sozusagen vorwegnehmen muss? Oder ist es mehr so eine allgemeine Betrachtung, ob etwas eine Handlung hilfreich oder nicht hilfreich ist? Und die Antwort lautet, dass man sich fragt, habe ich die richtige Absicht bei dem, was ich jetzt mache, und ist das, was ich tun will, auch geeignet, diesen Zweck zu erfüllen? Es ist nicht möglich, sich das bei jedem einzelnen Gedanken oder bei jedem einzelnen Schritt zu fragen, aber es geht so darum, im Großen und Ganzen, oder bei so Dingen, die man regelmäßig tut, wie zum Beispiel zur Toilette gehen oder so, sich diese Frage zu stellen, ob das jetzt der passende Moment ist. Oder auch in der Meditation kommt das auch vor. Und je stärker die Achtsamkeit entwickelt ist, umso mehr hat man wächst auch das Verständnis in diesem Zusammenhang, also ob das, was man tut, jetzt passend ist, um den Zweck zu erfüllen.
Okay, so this is very nice. This is the kind of comment I like. You know, this is what it says here. Ajahn Brahmali, I forgot to say, you are a very good teacher. So I decided. This is a real kind of note I like to see.
Ein Kompliment für Ajahn Brahmali, er ist ein sehr guter Lehrer.
Yeah. So, thank you for your guiding through the darkness here and all the time via the internet on the BSW site. Such a good idea, presumably the internet site. Okay, that's great. That's very kind of you to say that. So, yeah. I should keep that one, right? Okay. <no. laughs> Okay, dear Ajahn, how do I know when sleepiness is a need by the body or an escape route by the mind? And yeah, this is a good point. And what you have to do is you have to try it out. You have to test it for yourself. Sometimes what happens if you feel sleepy during the meditation, but then you actually try to go to sleep, you don't want to sleep anymore. Yeah, and that's how you know that it may be an escape route of the mind, because actually, you cannot sleep when you try, but when you don't try and meditate, then you cannot feel sleepy. That is when you know there may be a problem there. But don't be afraid of sleeping a little bit extra. Yeah, it's okay. Try that, especially if you fall asleep easily, then it may actually be a sign that you need some more rest. Because people are very different. Some people need to sleep more, some people need to sleep less. But generally, apparently, in our society, people sleep too little. That's what I read when I read about these things. So if you sleep a little bit extra, maybe it's good. Maybe that will kind of waken you up. So feel what happens when you sleep a certain amount. See if it makes you feel more bright during the day, or it makes you feel more dull. Yeah, there comes a point, if you sleep too much, it makes you feel dull, and then, of course, it's counterproductive. So find that nice balance where it's just right and you feel bright. In the long run, if you still feel sleepy, because even when you sleep enough, the reason for that usually is simply because you haven't purified yourself enough yet. Yeah, all the purification of the mind, all the sila, all of these things, it hasn't proceeded far enough. So when you sit down, you're lacking in the joy, lacking in the happiness, lacking in all those wholesome things that arise in here. And because of that, you kind of feel bored, or kind of, oh, I just, you know, you don't know what to do with yourself, so you fall asleep instead. So, but as you keep on reducing the general defilements in the mind, by far of the five hindrances, by far the most important ones are the first two, sensual desire and ill will. Especially ill will can make you very tired. So as you reduce these things, all the other defilements, all the five hindrances will decrease, and you will feel less tired as a consequence. So over time, you know, over when you come back next year, is it going to be another retreat next year? Maybe.
Are you coming back next year?
So maybe Maya, you can teach retreat next year.
You do plan something with Aya Mudita in any case.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Maybe bump it together.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. So when you come back next year to Aya Mudita or Bhantasiddhanta Supreme, then you have the opportunity to see whether your practice in the meantime is bearing fruit. Because when you come back next time and you feel more awake, you feel more light, you feel everything is going in the right direction, then you know that your practice is roughly correct also outside of the retreat. This is how you know that you're practicing the right way, that the mind is moving gradually over time to more wholesome states and less of the unwholesome ones.
Wie kann ich wissen, ob Schläfrigkeit ein körperliches Bedürfnis ist oder ob es eine Art Ausweichmanöver des Geistes ist? Man muss es selbst ausprobieren, indem man einfach probiert, was passiert, wenn man schläft. Also es kann sein, man fühlt sich schläfrig bei der Meditation und wenn man tatsächlich sich dann hinlegt und versucht zu schlafen, dann fühlt man sich plötzlich überhaupt nicht mehr müde. Das ist möglicherweise ein Hinweis, dass es eher ein Ausweichmanöver gewesen ist. Man muss auch nicht unbedingt Angst haben, dass man ein bisschen extra schläft. Im Allgemeinen schlafen die Leute in unserer Gesellschaft eher zu wenig. Wenn ein kleines Schläfchen den Geist klarer macht, dann war der Schlaf wohl nötig. Und wenn es den Geist trüber macht, dann war das die falsche Strategie. Also wenn man zu viel schläft, dann wird der Geist auch trübe davon. Wenn das über längere Zeit anhält mit dem Schlafproblem, dann kann es damit zusammenhängen, dass wir uns noch nicht genug gereinigt haben von unseren Trübungen, dass uns diese innere Freude und das Glücksgefühl einfach fehlen und dass wir stattdessen ein bisschen müde werden und uns schläfrig fühlen. Und von den 5 Hindernissen sind vor allem die ersten 2 in diesem Zusammenhang wichtig, das Verlangen und die Abneigung, der Unwille, vor allem das zweite ist sehr für die Müdigkeit verantwortlich.
Okay, so the next one is as follows. How do you relax the body at the beginning of a meditation? For example, if something is hurting here. Thank you. So the way to relax the body, I've been talking already about just being patient with the body, but of course your attitude to the body is important as well. So you have to have a kind of caring and a kind attitude to the body. And if you have sometimes you kind of focus on that area of pain or repair area where you're not relaxed with a kind of caring attention. And if you have a caring attention, often it tends to relax and it becomes more at ease because of that. So the attitude is so crucial when you do your meditation practice. And that's why sometimes when we use willpower, the willpower is like a negative attitude. It's a forced attitude. And that very often gives rise to tension, it gives rise to problem, it can even give rise to pain. And that's why it's so important to be relaxed at the beginning, not to use any willpower, just to allow things to flow along very nicely. And then when the mind is ready, only then do you watch the breath, because then you don't have to use so much willpower. So if you hurt a lot, I would suggest that often you cannot really do very much about that. You can attend to it if you like, and sometimes the hurt may dissolve through attention. But usually I would suggest changing your posture if that is a problem. Try sitting on a chair. If it still hurts when you're sitting on a chair, then maybe get up and do something else for a while and come back again. If, however, it is a chronic kind of pain that you always have, then of course you're going to have to learn to deal with it in a certain way, and then you're going to have to learn to accept the pain, basically. Again, it happens through a way, through a sense of care, a sense of metta for yourself, a sense of looking after yourself. And when you have that care, sense of care for yourself, softness, gentleness, all of these things, then it becomes easier to accept these things for what they are. Okay, the pain is there. Can't do anything about it. There's no an option except for accepting it for it is. And once that acceptance happens, then often the pain is lessened because the mental attitude is right. A lot of the pain comes from the wrong mental attitude. Acceptance is the opposite of that, and then the pain often disappears. So try that. Ajahn Brahm tells a very interesting story. When he was in Thailand, there wasn't many dentists in those days, in the northeast of Thailand, far away from kind of the modern convenience that we have these days. And he had a toothache. You may have heard this story before. A really, really bad toothache. And he didn't know what to do. He was kind of trying to do walking meditation, and he he says, he always exaggerates a bit, but he said he ended up running back and forth, you know, because the ache was so bad. And eventually he didn't know, there was no escape anymore. The toothache was just so bad. He decided to just sit down and accept it 100%. Yeah, and somehow he was able to do that. And he said the weird thing was the worst toothache that he had ever had in his entire life, it vanished like that. Yeah, completely gone. Just from one moment being incredibly unbearable, the second moment being completely gone. Of course, it takes quite a powerful mind to be able to accept things to that extent, but it gives you some idea of what acceptance can do if you have chronic pains in the body. Yeah.
Wie kann man den Körper am Beginn der Meditation entspannen, zum Beispiel, wenn etwas wehtut? Ich habe schon erwähnt, dass man mit sich selbst Geduld haben soll, und es ist auch wichtig, eine fürsorgliche Haltung zu sich selbst einzunehmen. Man kann sich zum Beispiel auf diesen Bereich des Körpers einstellen, wo der Schmerz ist oder wo man eben nicht entspannt ist, und oft stellt sich dann Entspannung ein. Wenn man Willenskraft anwendet, um in die Meditation hineinzukommen, ist das eine negative Haltung, und die führt eher zum Anstieg von Spannungen oder auch sogar zu Schmerzen. Und erst wenn der Geist dazu bereit ist, ist es sinnvoll, sich dann tatsächlich dem Atem zuzuwenden. Wenn ein Schmerz sehr stark ist, dann ist es empfehlenswert, die Körperhaltung zu ändern, zum Beispiel auf einem Stuhl zu sitzen oder so, oder vorübergehend was anderes zu tun. Und wenn es sich um einen chronischen Schmerz handelt, dann muss man lernen, damit umzugehen und ihn zu akzeptieren. Und da ist eben auch wichtig, diese Haltung von Fürsorglichkeit, Sanftheit, von Metta gegenüber sich selbst und diesem Schmerz. Und oft wird er dann auch weniger, wenn man eine solche Haltung einnehmen kann. Und es gibt diese Geschichte von Ajahn Brahm, als er in Thailand lebte. Damals gab es dort keine Zahnärzte, und er hatte einen schlimmen Zahnschmerz und versuchte alles Mögliche, um damit umzugehen, und nichts half. Und dann beschloss er irgendwann, ihn einfach zu akzeptieren, so wie er ist, zu 100%, und das ist ihm anscheinend gelungen, und von einem Moment zum nächsten war der Zahnschmerz weg.
Good. Okay. So, next question. Dear Ajahn, about not indulging in sensual pleasures, like traveling and music, I find it difficult to practice as a layperson because my work involves in creating. I find traveling and seeing new things and places gives me inspiration for my work. Is that considered as indulging in sensual pleasures? And the point here is that it is really now when you are on retreat that you don't indulge in sensual pleasures. What you do the rest of the time is slightly different. You don't live, you know, you can't live like this all the time. So don't worry about those kind of minor things. Traveling around is not a major issue. What matters is that you don't indulge so much in sensual pleasures that you end up breaking your precepts. That is the main issue. So make sure you keep those precepts. Yeah, that is what really matters. So you don't actually hurt anybody, and you don't kind of create bad karma in that sense. And indulgence in sensual pleasures from that is not a major problem. It is a little bit of a problem, because it may block the deeper aspects of meditation, but it's not a major problem on the path. The important thing is that you try to understand the problem of sensual pleasures through your practice. And when you see that it is a problem, then your mind will automatically move away from these things. That is the ideal thing. So when you come on the retreat, you get some nice meditation, right? And you check out your mind at that point, and you see that you're not interested in those things you were interested in before. Because you see them as a disturbance, you see them as an agitation, as a problem. You found a different happiness inside, which is far more powerful than the sensual happiness. And this is the ideal way of doing things, to kind of use your wisdom, use your meditation to naturally move away from these things. Not to use willpower, not to say, I'm not going to travel anymore because that's bad. From now on, I'm only going to eat bread and drink water, right, and nothing else. If you do that, boy, you're going to have a miserable life. You're going to be absolutely miserable, man. And you will never come back to any Buddhist retreat ever again in your entire life. So Please don't overdo things. Be wise about things. Don't use force. Don't do things that you're not ready for. Allow things to come naturally. If it comes naturally, it's easy. It's only when you force it that it's not easy.
Es geht darum, nicht in den sinnlichen Genüssen zu schwelgen, zum Beispiel Reisen oder Musik. Ich finde es schwierig, das als eine Laienperson so zu praktizieren, denn meine Arbeit beinhaltet etwas zu erschaffen oder ja, also kreativ zu sein. Und ich finde, dass Reisen und das Sehen neuer Dinge mich inspiriert und für meine Arbeit. Wird ich das als ein Schwelgen in sinnlichen Genüssen zu betrachten? Man muss unterscheiden zwischen der Situation in diesem Retreat hier, wo wir uns ein bisschen mehr zurückhalten, oder eben dem Alltag. Im Alltag ist vor allem das Problem, dass man nicht die Ethikregeln bricht. Dass man das Schwelgen nicht so weit treibt, dass man die Ethikregeln bricht. Ansonsten ist es an sich kein Problem. Es kann ein kleines Problem werden, wenn es die tieferen Aspekte der Meditation dann irgendwann blockiert. Und was hilft, ist einfach, dass man auf seinen Geist achtet. Und wenn man sieht, dass es ein Problem ist, wird der Geist sich automatisch auch davon entfernen wollen. Und es ist besser, die Weisheit zu benutzen und sich auf natürliche Weise davon wegzubewegen, anstatt versuchen, mit Willenskraft oder mit Gewalt das zu unterdrücken.
Okay, so the next one. We should see the good things in other people, but then how to point out when something is not right. Is this not a contradiction? Thank you. Not necessarily, because it means depends on what we mean by seeing the good in other people. Yeah, if something is not right in somebody else, and you need to point it out because they're doing something wrong or whatever else, and sometimes there's a way of getting angry with them because they're doing something wrong, or there's a way of being compassionate with them. Yeah, this is a different attitude. If you get angry with somebody because they're doing something wrong, it means you're thinking of them as a bad person, and that's why you need to get angry. But if you have compassion with them because you understand that they're making a mistake and you want to help them to get out of that mistake, then you are kind of pointing things out while at the same time seeing the good in that person rather than seeing the bad. You're seeing the suffering in them, right? And this suffering, or whatever it is that you're seeing, is a bit like seeing the good because it gives rise to a good quality in you, rather than actually giving rise to a bad quality in you. So not just about seeing the good, it can also be seeing the bad, but if we see the bad, it's the right attitude that we have in seeing the bad in other people.
Wir sollen in anderen das Gute sehen. Und wie können wir auf etwas hinweisen, was nicht richtig ist? Das ist kein Widerspruch. Es ist nicht notwendigerweise ein Widerspruch. Wenn jemand etwas falsch macht, ist es eine Möglichkeit, dass man darüber wütend wird, und eine andere Möglichkeit ist, dass man Mitgefühl entwickelt, wenn jemand etwas falsch macht. Und das sind zwei verschiedene Dinge. Das Wichtige ist die Haltung, die man einnimmt. Wenn man Mitgefühl entwickelt und der anderen Person helfen will, aus diesem Fehler herauszukommen, dann bedeutet das eigentlich auch, dass man das Gute in dieser Person sieht. Man sieht das Leiden in ihr. Das ist hier gehört in die gleiche Kategorie wie das Gute zu sehen. Denn es führt dazu, führt zu einer guten Qualität in einem selbst, anstatt dass es zu einer schlechten Qualität führen würde.
Okay, dear Anjan, what is the major quality of the Buddha that puts him above the other arahants? Basically, the liberation that you have and the ending of suffering and the happiness that you have and all of these things are the same if you are the Buddha or the arahant. There's no difference in liberation and these qualities. The main difference is that the Buddha arrived, that Buddhahood arrives at liberation through his own wisdom, through his own means, rather than relying on a teacher. Whereas all the other arahants, they rely on a teacher. That may not sound like much, it may not sound like a big deal, but actually it is a very big deal, because to arrive at we all have the opportunity to read these teachings, right? We all have the opportunity to practice accordingly here. So it's easy for us. And yet, if you look around, how many arahants are there here? Yeah, so we have it easy, relatively speaking. And yet, there aren't that many Aryas in the world, or arahants in the world. And then the Buddha, he didn't even have any teachings. And still, he was able to make the breakthrough and see things according to reality here. So that is the distinction. And of course, it takes much more, probably more wisdom. It takes more, more positive qualities in general to be able to do these things on your own. And that is the difference. And that is why, generally speaking, I think it's always good to go back to the word of the Buddha, because he obviously had some, there was something very special about him in that sense. You want to do that first then? Is it six, part two as well afterwards?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Was ist die hauptsächliche Qualität des Buddha, die ihn über die anderen Arahant stellt? Die Antwort ist, die Befreiung und das Beenden des Leidens ist das gleiche beim Buddha und bei anderen Arahants. Der Hauptunterschied steht darin, dass der Buddha dieses Ziel alleine erreicht hat, mit seinen eigenen Mitteln, ohne einen Lehrer zu haben. Und alle anderen Arahants haben einen Lehrer, nämlich den Buddha, gehabt. Und das klingt auf den ersten Blick, als wäre dieser Unterschied gar keine so große Sache, aber es ist tatsächlich schon eine große Sache. Wir haben es heute vergleichsweise einfach. Die Lehren sind da, die stehen uns zur Verfügung und dennoch gibt es nicht sehr viele Arahants auf der Welt. Ohne dass die Lehren oder ein Lehrer verfügbar ist, ist mehr Weisheit nötig und mehr gute Qualitäten nötig, um diesen Durchbruch zu schaffen. Und deswegen ist es empfehlenswert, immer zum Wort des Buddha zurückzugehen, weil er tatsächlich wirklich ein ganz außergewöhnlicher Mensch gewesen ist.
Okay, so the second part of this question is, you have read so much about the Buddha. How would you characterize him as a person? Did he have a sense of humor? So how would I characterize him as a person? It's very, very hard to tell because the suttas are so kind of standardized in a way. They have obviously gone through an editing process so that the kind of various descriptions of the jhanas, for example, or the Eightfold Path or the gradual training, they have been very standardized. And there's very little kind of personal information that actually kind of slips through that. And the Buddha isn't really described very much, right? It's mostly just the Buddha talking. So you have to kind of read his character into what he says. And it can be quite hard to read character traits into what he says. So I don't really know what to say about the Buddha as a person. Obviously, he was very, I can say kind of really bland things, like he was very kind, but it doesn't really, it doesn't add much to your knowledge of who the Buddha was, right? But it does seem very kind and compassionate and very always willing to help out and all of these good qualities, as you would expect, which of course is good. And also, he's very obviously keen on meditation. He takes retreats. He goes by himself to take a few weeks on retreat by himself, which is interesting because you wonder why does he do that? And sometimes it may have been maybe to investigate something or understand something that he hadn't understood before. It's possible. Just because you are a Buddha doesn't mean that you understand everything straight away. You understand certain things all the way to the bottom, like the nature of the mind, that kind of thing. But there are other things about the universe or being that perhaps you don't understand straight away, which is not part of the awakening experience. And it may be the Buddha investigated these things later on. Did he have a sense of humor? There is an English professor called Richard Gombrich, who was a professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University. He wrote about the Buddha's sense of humor. And he was the one who kind of was claiming, he was picking out certain passages in the suttas. I was trying to reflect just now which passages it was. I can't think of them anymore. But there were certain passages where he was arguing that the Buddha had definitely had a sense of humor. And of course, these are academics. And another academic said, no way, that has nothing to do with humor. The Buddha was kind of stoic. He was kind of, no messing around, that kind of thing. But in my experience, people who have gone a long way on the path, they actually do have a lot of humor. Ajahn Brahm tells the story of Ajahn Shah. Ajahn Shah was very famous for being very humorous and very funny. And in public, always very straight-faced and very stern, right? So you thought it was like on a very tough character. But in private, behind the scenes, often these monks would be very different. As Abraham tells the story of Ajahn Chah, he was telling some kind of joke or messing around or what, I'm not sure what he was doing here. And then the monk who is now the abbot of Wat Pathong, Ajahn Liam, he was in the room and he was laughing so much at Liam that he was literally rolling around on the floor, right? holding his stomach because he was laughing so much. And this is the sort of thing you would never see in public. You only see behind the scenes, right? You have to be part of the Sangha to see that kind of thing. So it seems like, you know, when you have a very light mind, yeah? You don't really have any worries anymore if you are an arahant. You're really relaxed in that thing. You don't care what other people think about you. All of that stuff is gone. So because of that, you tend to be very light-hearted. And I would say that would also come out, probably, in a sense of humor as well.
Also der zweite Teil der Frage betrifft den Buddha als Person. Wie kann man ihn beschreiben? Und hatte er Humor? Die Sutras sind sehr standardisiert und haben einen Bearbeitungsprozess durchlaufen und sie enthalten sehr wenig persönliche Informationen. Und der Buddha wird auch als Person nicht beschrieben, sondern er wird als der dargestellt, der redet und der spricht. Offensichtlich war er sehr freundlich und gütig und mitfühlend und er war auch sehr an Meditation interessiert und hat manchmal sich zu Retreats zurückgezogen für ein paar Wochen oder so. Und die Frage ist, warum hat er das gemacht? Möglicherweise hat er noch Dinge weiter erforscht, die nicht zu der direkten Erfahrung des Erwachens gehört haben. Und die Frage, hatte er einen Sinn für Humor? Es gibt einen englischen Forscher, Richard Gombrich, der ein paar Stellen zusammenträgt, mit denen er zeigen will, dass der Buddha sehr wohl einen Sinn für Humor hatte. Dann gibt es andere Wissenschaftler, die dann dagegen argumentieren. Das ist so der akademische Streit. Aber meine persönliche Erfahrung ist, dass Leute, die sehr weise sind, auch oft eine Menge Humor haben. Ajahn Brahm berichtet zum Beispiel über Ajahn Chah, dass er nicht unbedingt in der Öffentlichkeit, aber so im Privaten sehr witzig sein konnte. Und er erinnert sich an eine Szene, wo Ajahn Liam sich vor Lachen auf den Boden gekugelt hat und sich den Bauch gehalten hat über etwas, was Ajahn Chah gerade gesagt hat. Und Arahants haben wahrscheinlich einfach einen sehr leichten Geist, die haben keine Sorgen, es interessiert sie nicht, was andere über sie denken und das liegt doch nahe, dass sie auch Humor haben.
Okay, so the next one is as follows. Dear Bhante, do the Satta Sambhujangas, the seven factors of awakening, do they need to be developed and present in the mind simultaneously, or as and when each one comes into play? I noticed some aspect of this in me, to varying degrees, but they come and go. Thank you. Wow, that's really good. It's doing really well. That's great. So if you get this Sati Sambhujanga, a bit of happiness and things in the mind, that's really, really great. That's excellent. So the idea is that both of these are true to some extent. Basically, if you have the lower of the Bhujanga, the factors of awakening, the first one, Sati, which means the mindfulness factor of awakening, obviously arises first. And when that arises, none of the other ones are normally present, because this is the most basic one, yeah? And when you develop that one, that is when you move on to the Dhammavicaya Sambhujanga, the factor of awakening, which is the investigation of qualities, investigation of your mind. Yeah? And when you do those two together, they kind of move on to the energy. Yeah? And then, of course, when you come to energy, in a sense, you have all three, because the mindfulness is there, and you also have an investigation of Dhammas, because you have clear mindfulness. You know when the bad qualities start to arise, so you can kind of do an antidote to those bad qualities or whatever in there. So with each one, with each lower one, when it kind of, you develop the lower one, it turns into a higher one. And when you turn into the higher one, the lower ones also come with that. So when you come to the last one, the Upeka Sambhujanga, which is the factor of awakening, which is equanimity, or evenness of mind, all of the other qualities, tend to come with that. Not entirely, because things like piti will have disappeared, for example. That's only part of the process. And of course, dhammavicca will not really be there anymore. It could be, depending on how you define it. But generally speaking, the higher you go, you also include the other one with it, as in Ruvapa. And I think it's also fair to say is that even with the lower ones, there is some degree of the higher ones will also be present, but only two very weak aspects of them, if you like. Yeah. I hope that makes sense. I'm not sure. So.
Die Satsang Bhujangas, die Faktoren des Erwachens, müssen entwickelt werden. Müssen sie gleichzeitig im Geist entwickelt werden und gleichzeitig vorhanden sein? Oder ist es so, dass die einzelnen Faktoren immer zum Zug kommen? Und ich nehme manchmal einzelne von diesen Faktoren bei mir wahr zu einem gewissen Grad. Aber sie sind nicht stabil, sie kommen und gehen. Und das ist schon sehr gut, wenn die überhaupt schon da sind oder sich manchmal zeigen. Und beides kann zutreffen, sowohl dass sie gleichzeitig als auch absetzend nacheinander ins Spiel kommen. Wenn man also anfängt, sie zu entwickeln, dann kommen zuerst die unteren. Das erste ist der Faktor Achtsamkeit als Faktor des Erwachens. Und in dem Moment, wo das zuerst auftaucht, sind die anderen noch nicht vorhanden. Und wenn man dann weitergeht zum nächsten Faktor, die Erforschung des Dhamma oder auch die Energie, der dritte Faktor, dann sind die drei nachher gleichzeitig da. Und immer wenn man sich zu einem höheren weiterentwickelt, dann kommen die unteren Faktoren kommen mit, im Großen und Ganzen jedenfalls. Es gibt ein paar Ausnahmen, zum Beispiel Piti klingt mit der Zeit, wenn die Entwicklung weitergeht, ein bisschen ab. Oder auch die Erforschung des Dhamma ist vielleicht auch nicht immer so präsent mehr. Und man kann umgekehrt auch sagen, wenn die unteren Faktoren dabei sind, entwickelt zu werden, dann ist vielleicht so zumindest ein Ansatz von den höheren Faktoren auch schon mit im Spiel.
Okay, so we'll do the last one for tonight, I think. And it goes as follows. At the start of the guided meditation, you say to relax and feel good and to think positive. What if you are suffering from migraine? How can meditation help you not to identify yourself too much with the pain? Thank you. Okay, so I think if you have kind of strong headaches and this kind of problem, you have to be quite careful sometimes with meditation. Sometimes people get headaches from the meditation practice precisely because they use too much willpower. Yeah, there's this kind of thing they call samadhi headache, when you really kind of force yourself. And this shows you why samadhi should never be translated as concentration. Yeah, because it is by concentrating here, by forcing yourself, forcing your willpower onto a certain object, that's how these headaches arise. It shows you why concentration actually is a bad translation for samadhi, and why something like stillness is actually far, far preferable. So be careful so you don't make the headache worse. Yeah, this is one of the first things. So make sure that you relax and you kind of allow things to be. And a lot of it is, as I said before, with any kind of pain in the body, is the ability to accept that something is there, to let it be, to allow it to remain as it is, and not to kind of to always kind of be craving for it to go or to desire it to leave. As long as you have that desire for it to leave, it usually will get worse as a consequence. If you can accept it, usually it is not such a problem. And once you accept it, the strange thing is, it doesn't really matter so much anymore. Then you can focus on the loving kindness, or you can focus on the breath, and the headache kind of disappears in the background, as if it's, you know, it's there, but it doesn't really disturb you in your meditation. It's the same thing with any kind of pain. The moment you accept it, that's the moment you get mindfulness. And once you have mindfulness, it's as if you have a distance to the object. The pain is over here, you're over there. You're watching it as an object without getting involved. Yeah? And that sense of standing back and watching things, allowing them to be, that is what then makes it possible to accept it without and then going on with the meditation regardless of that pain. The pain just being in the background.
am Anfang der geführten Meditation heißt es immer, dass man sich entspannen soll und sich gut fühlen soll und dass man positiv denken soll. Was ist aber, wenn man Migräne hat? Wie kann die Meditation helfen, sich nicht zu sehr damit zu identifizieren, also mit dem Schmerz zu identifizieren? Mit Kopfschmerzen soll man vorsichtig sein. Kopfschmerzen können auch entstehen, wenn man in der Meditation zu viel Willenskraft und Gewalt anwendet. Man spricht auch von einem Samadhi-Kopfschmerz. Und das ist ein Grund, warum das Wort Samadhi niemals mit Konzentration übersetzt werden sollte, weil das Wort Konzentration sowas wie eine Anstrengung und eine Willenskraft nahelegt. Und das kann sehr kontraproduktiv sein. Und die Übersetzung als Stille ist viel besser. Was hier wichtig ist in diesem Zusammenhang, ist die Fähigkeit, den Schmerz zu akzeptieren. Und solange man das Verlangen hat, dass der Schmerz verschwinden soll, verschwindet er in der Regel nicht, sondern wird eher stärker. Und wenn es gelingt, ihn zu akzeptieren, dann ist er plötzlich gar nicht mehr so wichtig und stört nicht mehr so sehr. Er verschwindet mehr in den Hintergrund. Und mit der Achtsamkeit gelingt es dann, einen Abstand zu diesem Schmerz als ein Objekt zu finden. Das heißt, es ist ein Objekt, das man betrachtet und man ist damit weniger identifiziert. Das kann sehr hilfreich sein.
Okay, that's all for this evening here. So we'll see you again tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock here. And let's just do the outline summer we're done before we go.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāma